So, I'm glad to be here with you all this morning. I have prepared a talk whose title is Nonviolence Facing in All Directions. So, I was sitting in my home a couple days ago, and I was like, geez, I don't know what I'm going to talk about on Sunday. And my wife, Colleen, reminded me that the last few years I've given a talk that had to do with Dr. Martin Luther King and nonviolence, because I happened to have given the talk the day before Martin Luther King Jr. Day, last couple of years, and I was, oh, good, yes, I want to do that. And then, of course, as one does, I was reading the Gandavyuha chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra. And I encountered the teachings of a girl, a great bodhisattva named Matriyani, who says, I have attained the state of facing in all directions. And then it all sort of just came into view. Matriyani says, I have attained the state of facing in all directions. And you could take this to mean many things, but here I'll just say this relates to nonviolence in that nonviolence, a key component of it is not turning away. Not turning away. So the tendency of consciousness is to pick a pretty small piece of whatever is going on and focus there. And we are conditioned to turn away from many places where there is violence and harm. And facing in all directions is a way of opening up and saying, I am not turning away. I am not turning away. Facing in all directions also evokes a quality of non-grasping or not pinning things down. So the tendency of consciousness is to face in a particular direction and sort of say, ah, this is the thing that we're doing here. And as soon as it does that, it is conditioned to say, well, should I get some more of this or get rid of it? And just how should I do that? And then it just gets very control-y, graspy. So facing in all directions is a way of opening up beyond that tendency to narrow down and get caught by the illusion of control. Another way of thinking, it's like non-limiting. By practicing unlimited awareness, we are not engaging in limiting things by the tendencies of our mind. So Matriyani, she says the way she got to the practice of facing in all directions is she got something from some Buddhas, which is she got access to perfect wisdom by way of the array of totality through various ways of entry into it, each different. So I want to make sure you all got that. So just if you'd say that back. This is the style of discourse of the Avatamsaka Sutra. So get ready. Access to perfect wisdom by way of the array of totality through various ways of entry into it, each different. So this is a three-part formulation. Access to perfect wisdom. So perfect wisdom is a translation of Prajnaparamita. If you're new here, well, Prajnaparamita is pretty good. If you're come here in the morning, you'll get to bow down because the main object of veneration and worship in this place of practice when we do something that looks like veneration and worship is Prajnaparamita, which is the ungraspability of everything. That's what I get up in the morning and I sit zazen and then we do a service and I bow down and I say, yes, I'm bowing down to the ungraspability, the uncontrollability, the ungettability, the unattainability, the not get rid of ability of everything that I think is gettable, attainable, controllable, or get rid ofable. And, you know, oftentimes Prajnaparamita is talked about as being about the emptiness of things. So emptiness as in empty of a separate lasting self. But the reason that you have a teaching that is about this quality of things is to give us a way of accessing life where we can let go of constantly trying to control, gain, dominate, in the language of bell hooks, to dominate, and rather practice non-domination. So she says, Matriani says, I have access to perfect wisdom by way of the array of totality. So this is the second piece. So we have Prajnaparamita, totality, and then the various ways. So totality, that's like a wholeness, completeness. So by seeing that everything is ungraspable, that there's nothing separate, that there's nothing that can be gained, she's able to see that everything is already whole and complete. When you read spiritual texts, you'll often see this kind of language of a vast wholeness that people realize with their beings. And it feels good. It feels good. Mostly I want to talk about this aspect in terms of affect. Do you have some sense of when you feel fractured, cut off, alone, separate, everything looks like a mass of separated components in conflict, and how painful that is? And you have some sense of when you feel like things are whole, complete, connected. If you don't, I invite you to investigate your experience, because I think it's there. This is part of how we experience life, and it affects how we feel and how we act and how we think. But she says, by finding access to Prajnaparamita, perfect wisdom, the ungraspability of things, that opens up into the sense of the whole. Because when we're always trying to grasp everything, we have to make it small to get graspable. And then we're kind of stuck. She says, I have access to perfect wisdom by way of the array of totality, perfect wisdom, wholeness. And then, she says, through various ways of entry into it, each different. So when you talk about wholeness, some people say, we're all one. Well, sort of, absolutely, and totally not. That's how Buddhism describes this situation. So she sees a wholeness, but the only way to access that wholeness is through the distinct experience of this moment. So the idea isn't that like you practice meditation and suddenly you can actually experience existing 1,000 years ago, or that you can experience existing in another place. But you can recognize through this moment of experience the totality of how those things are connected. But it's always and only through a distinct moment of experience like this. Actually, it's this one already. How cool is that? And so this is about how things are various. They're different. Your response to each situation is different. Your response to that wholeness and that ungraspability, there's always room for a skillful response. So if we made this formulation really small, I could say she's accessed the fact that everything is ungraspable, it's whole, and it's like this. And that's always true. And you might say, wow, it's really obvious to me that things are graspable. And we have all kinds of discourse and practices and methodologies and encounters and intimacies to find the ungraspability of things, but I'm not going to talk about it a whole lot today, so just stick around. Because do you want to be free or not? Once things are to be controlled, they're not free. And once you have to control them, you're creating non-freedom, and you're not free. This is why in Mahamudra literature from the Buddhist tradition, I kept reading this stuff, and they'd be like, all our practices is just realize everything is already liberated. And I was like, it doesn't feel liberated. But they're like, you just think it's graspable, so you think it's not free, so you're bound. But it's not really true that it's graspable. So So I want to say a few things about, or use a few quotations and teachings from Dr. Martin Luther King that relate to this ungraspability, wholeness, and particularness. So, Dr. King once said, this is the unusual thing about nonviolence. Nobody is defeated. This is the unusual thing about nonviolence. Nobody is defeated. It's not about control. It's not about controlling things. In the language of bell hooks, she likes the language of non-domination. It's not about dominating. So our engagement, our liberative action, doesn't have to be about dominating, controlling, grasping. It can be about freeing. Because if we're dominating, we're just doing the whole thing we don't want to do. This is the unusual thing about nonviolence. Nobody is defeated. So, Dr. King also, I'll relate this to the idea of totality, wholeness, or completeness. He once said, "We may have arrived on different ships, but we're all in the same boat now." We may have arrived on different ships, but we're now in the same boat now. The magnanimity of this statement is astonishing if you consider the ships he's talking about. The ships that carried people of European descent to the United States in relation to the ships that carried people of African descent. The brutality and horror of those slave ships, of which there were tens of thousands. And yet, he says, we're all in the same boat now. To recognize through that particularity that still there is wholeness unbroken. It's very powerful. And it's possible. But, you know, I'm a long way from being Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in countless ways. And so I'd like to come back to particularity and say, well, let's just extend this metaphor a little bit and say, yes, we may have arrived on different ships. We're now in the same boat now. And isn't it peculiar that the people on the upper decks and in all the nice staterooms have a tendency to be white? And the people in steerage tend to be people of color. And people up on the deck tend to say things like, well, you know, I just worked hard and bought this stateroom. So you should just work hard. There are people downstairs saying, there are no jobs, and so forth. Particularity. People have distinct identities that are constructed by conditions that we arrive with in each moment that's our ground for engagement, for liberation. Saying everybody is one is not complete. And wouldn't it be sad? Isn't the vast diversity of human experience amazing? But we could have that without having so much violence within the system. That's possible. I believe that. Dr. King believed that. So, coming back to this access to perfect wisdom by way of array of totality through various ways of entry into it, each different. Every moment is it each different particular way to enter into the ungraspability of things and their wholeness. And it's always different. Sometimes it's like you're just like, I feel really not all graspy, and I feel really open, and I feel connection. And you'd be like, well, this is an easy moment to enter into that. And other times, you're like, rah! It's still an opportunity. It's still an opportunity. And this facing in all directions, with which I began, is what this, which this opens up into, is a being able to be with all of it. To be with the whole, to not turn away from violence. Nonviolence, I may have said this before, I think I'll say it a whole bunch more times. Nonviolence is to see where violence is, to go there and embody nonviolence. It's not turning away. And meditation is like this. You know, you sit down and you just quit attacking, controlling. You have a few moments where you just pull back and you go, well, this is what's happening. That plant seeds of nonviolence that are powerful. So, I'm going to read you a little story, because stories are good. This is a passage. The story I'm going to read is a passage from the Gandavyuha chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra. The book title of the only existing English translation is called Entry into the Realm of Reality. Because the idea of this particular Buddhist tradition is that we are not seeing wholeness and ungraspability. We tend to just see particularity. But through particularity, we can see the wholeness and ungraspability. And so the language of the text is meant to blow your mind. So when I'm reading this, you might be like, dang, this is weird. What is even happening here? And I would just say, see if you can let your mind be blown. It's all right. It's designed to kind of shake up patterned ways of limiting and landing and open up to something more fresh. The Gandavyuha is the last chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra, and it is the story of a young man. This is not like intended to be, or doesn't have any claim to be a historical document. It's just a story of a young man named Sudana, who really wakes up to a profound aspiration to liberate everything from suffering. And so he asks someone, like, how can you do that, who he thinks is really wise, and they tell him something amazing, and he goes, I get that, yeah. And then he goes, but, I mean, I get that, but there's got to be more. And so he goes to see 75 more super incredible, amazing, attained beings, and they all blow his mind. And he keeps saying, I got to keep practicing until every being is free. I will not stop. And so, about a quarter of the way through his journey, he meets someone, I can't remember their name, it's very long in Sanskrit, and they have an amazing encounter, and it's like, wow! And then he says, well, I really get what you're saying, but there must be more. And they go, yeah, you should go see the girl Maitrayani. She's got something for you. So he sets out to see Maitrayani, and that's the passage I'll read for you. And Maitrayani doesn't really say how old she is, just by a vague inference from the context. I just want to say you might want to visualize her as being like a 12-year-old girl. 12-year-old girl, given various clues in the text. So anyway, I'm going to read this to you. Generally speaking, the Avatamsaka's value is reading as a what we call a samadhi text or a meditative text. So you read it as a meditation practice. And so what I'm going to do here is I'm going to read this to you, and then I'm going to do a guided meditation that emerges from the teaching on facing all directions that Maitrayani gives. And so I'm going to invite you to find a posture that's conducive to meditation, so you can bring into your consciousness through the body samadhi, which is available anywhere. But the posture may be a benefit. And I'm going to invite you to close your eyes throughout this reading and guided meditation. The guided meditation will be I'll be asking you to do things with your mind, and if your mind doesn't seem to do the things I'm suggesting, don't worry about it too much. Just open up into what occurs through the process. So here Sudana has resumed his journey looking for Maitreyani. Then, with inconceivable respect for spiritual benefactors, the great zeal purified, ready for the great vehicle, seeking enlightened knowledge, absorbed in the way to enlightenment, seeking association with spiritual friends, dwelling in the sphere of the teaching, approaching unhindered knowledge, realizing that past, present, and future are ultimately one instant, aware of ultimate non-duality like space, sure of the ultimacy of non-duality, devoted to discipline whose goal is freedom from obstruction, intent on ultimate harmony in action, intent on the knowledge to tear apart the net of conceptions of all sentient beings, free from attachment to any land, his mind not attached to the congregations of the Buddhas or to the purities of the Buddha lands, perceiving all sentient beings as void of self or inherent identity, realizing that all sounds are like echoes and eminently aware that all forms are like reflections, Sudana gradually made his way to the city Simhavirajambita looking for the girl Maitreyani. He was told, "The girl Maitreyani, daughter of the Raja Simhaketu, with a retinue of 500 girls, is up on the roof of a palace of radiant jewels, sitting on a seat set on sandalwood legs and draped with nets of strings of jewels and arrayed with celestial cloth, expounding spiritual teaching." Hearing this, Sudana entered the city, went to the house of the Raja, and stood at the outer foyer, desirous of seeing the girl Maitreyani. There he saw hundreds of thousands of people going in. He asked them where they were going and why they had come, and they told him they were going to Maitreyani to hear the teaching. He thought to himself, "No one is prevented from going in." So he went in. Having gone in, he saw the palace of radiant jewels set on a crystal base with pillars of lapis lazuli and walls of diamond, ornamented with 100,000 projections of gold, furnished with countless jewel mirrors, arrayed with world-illumining jewels spread with countless jewel nets, graced with inconceivable arrays of beautiful sounds from 100,000 golden bells shaken by the breeze. He also saw the girl Maitreyani, with dark eyes, black hair, and golden skin. Sudana paid his respects to her and said, "Noble one, I have set my mind on supreme perfect enlightenment, but I do not know how an enlightening being is to learn and carry out the practice of enlightening beings." She said, "Look at the adornments of my palace." Looking all around, in each wall, each pillar, each mirror, each figure, each formation, each jewel, each golden bell, each jewel tree, each girl's body, each jewel necklace, he saw reflected images of the Buddhas in the cosmos, with their first inspirations, spheres of practice and vows, manifestations of emergence in the world, mystical transformation on attainment of enlightenment, turnings of the wheel of teaching, just as the sun, moon, and stars in the sky are seen reflected in a clear, limpid pool of water, so did all the Buddhas of the cosmos appear reflected in each object of the luminous jewel palace. This as a result of the girl Maitreyani's past roots of goodness. Having viewed this, holding in mind the features of this supernal array of visions of Buddhas, Sudana joined his hands in a gesture of respect and turned his attention to Maitreyani's words. She said, "I have attained access to perfect wisdom from the array of totality. I sought this from Buddhas as numerous as grains of sand in the 36 Ganges rivers, and those Buddhas introduced me to the means of access to perfect wisdom by way of the array of totality through various ways of entry into it, each different." Sudana said, "What is the sphere of this means of access to perfect wisdom by way of the array of the totality?" She said, "Focusing my attention on this access to perfect wisdom by way of the array of totality, meditating on it, following it, pondering it, contemplating it, making it familiar, keeping it in mind, putting it in order, putting it into effect, thoroughly examining it, I developed a mental control called facing in all directions. Facing in all directions. I invite you to focus your attention on the field of sound. See if you can recognize or acknowledge that your awareness of sound faces in all directions. And I will begin to invite you to develop or concentrate awareness on other aspects of what is experienced. But the idea is to build a field of awareness. So not leaving behind this sense of sound facing in all directions, but adding to or building on it. Now I invite you to bring attention to the physical sensations along the spine. And then let awareness of physical sensations radiate from the spine throughout the body, extending around the back of the body, the sides, the top of the body, the base, around the front, allowing awareness of the body to be facing in all directions. And now, still aware of the field of sound in all directions, the body, noticing the visual field, see if you can let go of any sense of focusing on an object within the visual field. Just be aware of the complete field. And just see if you can begin to let go of the sense that you're facing in a direction and open up into a sense that the visual field is facing in all directions. And then, As we begin to open the eyes, just allow consciousness to do whatever it does. Be aware of what's happening right now. And you can feel free to rearrange the body, adjust the posture, wiggle around a little bit. It's all right. So, the root meditation practices we do here, one of the things that we can understand that they are about is nonviolence. So, from a Mahayana perspective, kind of the root thing that creates harm is the tendency of the mind to make dualisms or to narrow the range of things and say it's got an object. And so that's why the literature is all about seeing through that tendency, and that's liberation. So another way of putting this is there's a very subtle violence to acts of consciousness that are happening all the time. And this is producing the kind of world we experience, in which there is suffering. So when we practice, you know, people do zazen. Zazen means various things. But if I just take two of the principal practices people will do here, called zazen, one is would be to be focusing on the breath in the body, which has a million wondrous qualities, so I'm just picking one thing out here. And the other would be to practice shikantaza, just sitting without an object of contemplation or an object we are trying to get. So when you practice mindfulness of breath, from a Mahayana perspective, you're still participating on a subtle level with a type of violence or harm, which is you're creating an object. The breath is not actually an object of your consciousness. It seems like that to you, and you're kind of affirming that by saying, I'm looking at it. But it's good because we're like this all the time, so we can't just jump out of it usually. But here's the thing. Mindfulness, so this is the basic aspect of mindfulness, is you pick an object and you focus on it. That's what mindfulness practices are. And mindfulness has two basic qualities. One is a what and one is a how. So the what is we choose to focus on something. For example, the breath or the whole body or the field of sound or a person or, you know, could be a lot of different things, emotions. But the second aspect is the how. And the how is almost always without needing to fix, judge, or control. So we establish, we're going to have a relationship with this thing, and then what we do with it is radically nonviolent. Because we do this non-grasping, non-controlling, non-figuring out. And that plants seeds in our consciousness of a capacity to engage with things in a nonviolent way. And I say radical nonviolence, meaning at the root of the moment of experience, at the root of how consciousness functions. Not like radical, like you're blowing things up or whatever it means to other people. So, shikantaza takes it another level because we say there is no object that we concentrate on and there's no object we're trying to attain. So it's really radically leaping into the practice itself is ultimately and completely a diving into nonviolence. But then what happens is you see your mind goes, bah! Oh, it's making that stuff again. And then can we respond to that with nonviolence? You can. You can. And one of the things that happens through these meditation practices is stuff comes up, you know? So a lot of what our consciousness does is turns away in a conditioned manner. It's trying to avoid looking at most stuff. So when you just sit, sometimes it's like stuff comes up, you're like, where did that come from? Well, you weren't turning away, so you saw it. So now you have an opportunity to be nonviolent with it. How cool is that? How cool is that? And if you practice this, you can get good at doing it in other places. So you can go meet other people. And when things are difficult, instead of being like, I either have to turn away from this or try and control it, you can say, I'm here. I've gone to where the suffering is, where the violence is, where the harm is, and I will be radically nonviolent. That's possible. Your ability to do it can be strengthened and developed, and it be taken into all spheres of your life, into your public life. We're all already in a public life. Imagine that. You go live in a little hut. You're still part of the whole thing. How are you doing it? If you go live in a hut, can you do it in a way that's not turning away from suffering? Or if you choose to participate in the economic system we have now, can you not turn away? Can you turn towards? Can you meet that with something that's genuinely transformative? I think you can. I think you can. So I'll just give you a couple little summarizing phrases about what I'm talking about here. So I might say, facing all directions, I do not turn away. I do not turn away. And I might also say, coming to Maitreyani's longer formulation of ungraspability, wholeness, and particularness, I will embody nonviolence now. All things are ungraspable. All things are whole. And all things are like this. Now is my opportunity to do something liberative, to do something nonviolent. And there's nothing wrong with doing something joyful while you're there. Thank you. So, we have time for other people to say things, and I invite such speech.
I think nonviolence is the hardest at home. My husband lets his coffee get cold, and it always pisses me off. So this morning I served him half a cup of coffee, you know, and he went and filled it up. And then it got cold. And then he put it in the microwave. And, you know, just listening to this talk, it's like, well, there was about 10 times I grasped on that this morning.
Yeah, and laughing about it can be a way of loosening it up, just putting it out there, loosening it up. And but the seeing what you're seeing is suffering, and I know you know how to meet that suffering with nonviolence. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thinking about this, this was really useful talk for a lot of things I'm thinking through right now, and also thinking about Dr. King's legacy also of activism. I'm thinking about the kind of confusing, necessary paradox, Cohen, something in sort of like how nonviolently meeting the ungraspability of suffering, but still needing to choose an action. And like figuring out. What what is the place that, like, we put our bodies or our energies when it is ungraspable and endless?
Mm.
And what is, like, the right way? And how do you do that without grasping onto the outcome?
Yeah, those are questions that come up over and over again. Yeah, so it's painful. The problem with not turning away is that you see some bad stuff, you know, and it's painful. So one thing I can say, just to be, what this teaching for me enables me to do is to act and then just act. That's what I'm hoping for, and that's when it's at its best, is the ungraspability releases me from being really frustrated because it's never going the way I want it to. And that's a practice of building that capacity over and over again. So what this is, what Buddhism is generally trying to do is direct us towards our agency rather than the illusion of control. So I can feel my power. Because we get overwhelmed. You know, you surface all directions, you feel powerlessness. So then I say, this teaching is trying to remind me I have power now. I'm suffering now, so the most beneficial thing I can do is take care of my suffering. Then, oh, I see that suffering, and I'm not overwhelmed, so I have the capacity to go there and meet that. But we do, you kind of have to make a choice, because that's the problem. I'm sure everyone in here is like, well, we've got like, racism, white supremacy, we got like gun violence, we got climate change, you know, you're just like, oh my god, what do I do? And you can't do everything. That's okay. It's okay. So this is not intended to make us overwhelmed, but be able to learn that we can touch these systems of suffering, realize we're a part of them. If it's too painful, take care of our suffering within ourselves, and then again, make a choice. And, yeah. Bell Hooks once wrote, our willingness, this applies, she's speaking specifically to racism, but it has a much broader implication, I think. She says, our willingness to accept responsibility for the elimination of racism need not be engendered by feelings of guilt, victimization, moral responsibility, or rage. This is very hopeful. It means you can really step into it without having to feel all that terror. And this, I believe this practice helps us to wake up to something much bigger, which is what Dr. King was talking about, is love. To use strategy and tactics, but have it be informed by an all-encompassing sense of a wholeness within love and connection. Thank you. Yeah.
Do we, how would we, how do you differentiate between, obviously, talked a lot about nonviolence. How do we differentiate between violence? What's the difference between violence and conflict?
Yeah, nice. I think that there, this is one of those things that it's a semantic distinction, so different people would use those words in different ways, or even the people in this room have different associations. So we can't say this is absolute, but I can play with it here and put particular meanings on it. And what I can say is, the conflict is here. Or another way, I'll say it this way, conflict and violence are inherent in our human situation. So what we're looking to do is be like, instead of trying to avoid that or ignore it or pretend it's not there or dominate it, or I'm going to just go there and not be the one who's making it worse. I quoted this during the last talk too, but Dr. King once said, we who engage in nonviolent direct action are not the creators of tension. We merely bring to surface tension which is already alive. So this points to the fact that he recognizes the conflict is there, and you go there, but what you're doing is you're not adding conflict. You're entering into it in a way that is different and informed by the sense of non-defeat, non-violence, non-control.
I notice in a lot of my life experience that when I have not turned away, I have been broken.
And when I've been broken, I felt then that I needed to leave because I was not useful. And yet, as my practice matures, I find that brokenness is the place from which action, true wholeness can actually emerge. And yet I notice in my conditioning that idea that when you're broken, you have nothing to offer.
Yeah, we know that's not true. We know that's not true. I'm just going to kind of bounce on that because I really like to quote people who are amazing. I think I can do this. Brian Stevenson is a really incredible lawyer and social justice activist whose book Just Mercy is, I cannot recommend any book more. And he once said, there is a power and a strength in knowing our brokenness. It is only through knowing our brokenness that we can recognize our need for mercy. And then, if we are fortunate, our need to recognize other people need mercy. We have to see that. I think so. But, you know, I also just, because it's real for me, I got to say, my engagement with this seems kind of heavy. You're like, damn. Well, it is heavy. But at the same time, if you practice in this way, if you take this into your being that you're not in control of it, if you really can feel that, I can act, I'm not in control, you're free. And it's very joyful. And I see this all the time. I see people who have no idea all these fancy words I like to say in Sanskrit who manifest it, who just keep standing up and doing amazing things and realizing they're not going to fix it all. And they come together and they make connections. And it's very beautiful. And I see that happening here because people come here because they're often quite broken. That's why I came here. And that's been my experience. May it be yours, and if it's not, yours is your own various way of entry into the realm of reality. Wonderful. You can share that. That's your power. It's your ground of liberation for everyone. Thank you all.